You flip a switch on the wall and, you know, a light comes on. You plug in your laptop and it charges. We tend to think of electricity as this clean, docile, completely invisible river of energy just flowing obediently through the wires behind our drywall.
Right. It's out of sight, out of mind for most of us.
Exactly. But today, we are going to completely dismantle that illusion. For this deep dive, we are pulling from a stack of sources anchored by a highly technical engineering text. It's called Busbar Short Circuit with Stand and Mechanical Design Principles.
It's a heavy read, but the implications are just fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. And our mission today is to decode the hidden, honestly incredibly violent physics that happen behind the scenes of our electrical grids when something goes wrong. Because, well, when a short circuit hits, electricity stops being an invisible flow. It transforms into a massive, literal physical force.
Right. It becomes a sheer mechanical force, capable of bending solid metal bars and shattering heavy industrial insulators as if they were, as if they were fragile glass. The sheer speed and scale of that physical transformation is the defining challenge for electrical engineers.
Because we aren't talking about a gradual overload where wires just slowly get warm, right?
Not at all. Under short circuit fault conditions, the current flowing through a system can instantly spike 20 to 30 times higher than its normal rated value.
Yeah.
And that massive surge happens in fractions of a millisecond.
Wow. So we are talking about a physical shockwave happening almost instantly. It really changes how you picture the grid.
It really does. If the internal supports in these systems fail during a fault, you aren't just blowing a fuse, you're looking at catastrophic, widespread station blackouts.
But before we get into the brilliant engineering that actually defends against this, we need to understand the threat environment itself. The text points out a fascinating paradox about where these failures are most likely to happen.
Yes, the location of the greatest danger is usually not what people expect.
Right. Because if you ask me, I'd assume the most dangerous place for a massive physical failure would be those giant, high-voltage outdoor substations, you know, the ones with the massive steel towers.
Most people assume that, but the reality is highly counterintuitive. High-voltage installations certainly deal with immense power, but they benefit from one massive structural advantage, which is physical space.
Oh, because they're outside.
Exactly. Out in the field, you have generous insulation gaps. The conductors are spaced far apart. High voltage actually means lower fault current densities, relatively speaking. And because they're usually built out in the open air, the environment naturally helps quench and dissipate the heat and plasma of electrical arcs.
But then you compare that to low voltage or LV switchgear. We're talking about those mundane gray metal cabinets sitting in the basement of a hospital, an office building, or a factory floor.
Right, and that is where the environment becomes incredibly hostile. In low voltage systems, you have the highest fault current densities anywhere on the entire grid.
Because everything is just crammed together.
Exactly. The physical clearances between the different phases of power, the bare metal bars carrying the electricity, are minimal. Sometimes they are separated by just a few inches. Plus, all of this is packed into a sealed metal enclosure.
So there's nowhere for the energy to go.
None at all. If a failure occurs and an arc flash ignites, all of that explosive, rapidly expanding energy is trapped inside a steel box.
That is terrifying. Let's visualize that failure for a second. Walk us through the physical sequence of events inside that metal cabinet when a severe short circuit actually hits.
It unfolds as a violent cascade. First, the short circuit current surges, instantly generating a sudden, massive magnetic force. That force slams into the bus bars.
And bus bars are simply the thick, solid metal conductors, right? Sure. Usually copper or aluminum.
Yeah, exactly. They carry the main power through the cabinet, and they are held in place by synthetic or ceramic insulators. Now, if that sudden magnetic force hits harder than the physical load rating of those insulators, the insulator simply snaps.
So the physical anchor is just gone.
Gone. Completely. And with the support broken, the solid metal bus bar is free to deflect. The magnetic force keeps pushing, bending the heavy metal bar until it touches or gets dangerously close to the adjacent power phase.
And the moment it gets too close to the next phase, boom.
A sustained three-phase electrical arc. It vaporizes the metal, flashes over whatever insulation is left, and triggers a total station blackout.
Wow.
Yeah. The terrifying part of the cascade is that every single step amplifies the damage of the previous step.
Hold on, I'm confused here. Let me stop you, because I think this is where a lot of people, myself included, might get tripped up on the basic logic of a grid.
Okay, sure. What's the sticking point?
If there's a short circuit, shouldn't there be an upstream circuit breaker on the line? Like, doesn't the breaker just pop, kill the power instantly, and save the equipment? Why do the metal bars take any damage at all if the power is cut?
That is the most common misconception, and it perfectly highlights why mechanical design is so critical. The breaker absolutely will trip. But mechanical breakers are physical devices with springs, levers, and moving contacts.
Right, they have to physically move.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They take physical time to open, maybe 50 milliseconds, sometimes longer.
Which sounds fast to us, but in electrical terms, that's an eternity.
An absolute eternity. The magnetic forces we are talking about reach their absolute destructive peak long before that breaker opens. They peak during what engineers call the first asymmetric cycle of the fault.
Wait, what does first asymmetric cycle mean in plain English?
Well, under normal conditions, alternating current waves smoothly up and down, perfectly balanced above and below zero.
Yep.
But when a fault strikes abruptly, the current doesn't stay perfectly centered.
It gets knocked off balance.
Precisely. It gets violently shoved off center by the characteristics of the grid, creating a massive lopsided initial wave before it eventually settles into a symmetrical rhythm. That huge lopsided initial surge is the asymmetric cycle.
So the physical punch lands before the system security guard even realizes a fight has started.
That's a great way to put it. The bus bar and its supports must physically absorb and survive that peak force in the first few milliseconds.
Or else the whole system is doomed anyway.
Right. If the bus bar bends and creates a new arc in that tiny window of time, the breaker's action might be completely bypassed. The structural integrity has to hold the line first, or the electrical protections are useless.
That paints a terrifying picture. We're fighting an invisible ghost that hits like a freight train, and we have to survive the hit before we can even turn the power off. So let's look at the actual physics of this invisible force. The text focuses heavily on the Lorentz force.
The Lorentz force dictates how magnetic fields interact with moving electrical charges. When you have short circuit current flowing through adjacent parallel bus bars, each bar generates its own intense magnetic field.
And because they're sitting right next to each other in that tiny cabinet, those magnetic fields interact.
Exactly. Depending on the direction of the currents, the fields either violently push the heavy metal bars apart or slam them together.
The source text gets really deep into the math here, and it mentions specific variables. There's the initial symmetrical short circuit current, which calls I co double prime, and then the massive peak current called IP. How do you get from the baseline fault to that massive lopsided peak you mentioned?
The link between them is a variable called the kappa factor. Kappa represents the specific ratio of resistance to inductance in the electrical grid at that exact location.
Okay, so resistance is how much the wires fight the flow, and inductance is essentially electrical momentum.
That's a perfect way to think of it.
Yeah.
If a location has high inductance, high momentum, the kappa factor goes up, meaning that lopsided asymmetric peak is going to be incredibly high.
So getting that kappa factor right is critical.
It is life or death for the equipment. If an engineer miscalculates kappa, they underestimate the peak current. And that leads to the most brutal part of the math. The physical force doesn't scale linearly with the current. It scales with the square of the current.
Oh, wow. That squaring is what turns a bad situation into a catastrophic one.
Exactly. Let's say the current spikes to 30 times its normal rated value. The physical force pushing on those metal bars doesn't just multiply by 30, it multiplies by 900.
It's exponential disaster. So an oversight in calculating the peak current results in a massive underestimation of the physical force ripping at the cabinet.
And just when you think you've calculated that 900-fold increase, there is a hidden variable in all this that acts like an invisible multiplier. The natural frequency.
Everything in the physical world has a natural frequency, right? Like the specific rate at which it naturally wants to vibrate. A metal bus bar span is no different. We call its natural frequency FAC.
Right. And this is where we enter the resonance trap.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about the resonance trap. Because in a standard power grid in Europe or much of the world, the system runs at 50 hertz. The current alternates 50 times a second. But the text says the electromagnetic force pulses at twice that frequency, 100 hertz. Why is it twice as fast?
Because the physical force pushes on both the positive swing and the negative swing of the alternating current wave. It doesn't care which direction the electrons are moving, the magnetic interaction still pushes the bars. So 50 electrical cycles equal 100 mechanical shoves every single second.
Oh, I see. Is this basically like someone pushing a child on a swing? If you push at random times, you disrupt the momentum. But if you push at the exact moment, the swing starts moving away from you, like matching its natural rhythm.
The swing goes higher and higher. Yes, that mechanical resonance is the perfect analogy.
Wow.
If the natural frequency of the physical bus bar happens to sit right around 100 hertz, every single magnetic shove hits at the perfect moment to amplify the vibration. The engineering standard defines this with a dynamic amplification factor called V sigma.
And normally, what is V sigma?
Under normal stiff conditions where the frequencies don't match, V sigma is around 1.0. The static force is the total force. But near resonance, V sigma shoots up to 3 or even 5.
Meaning the already massive force we calculated earlier, the one that was squared and multiplied by 900, is now being multiplied by another 3 to 5 times just because the metal is vibrating at the wrong pitch.
Precisely. The structural load on the insulators far exceeds any static math. The text specifically notes that long substation spans using lightweight aluminum conductors are incredibly vulnerable to falling into this exact 100 hertz resonance trap.
So engineers are up against forces squaring themselves, plus the threat of the metal literally vibrating itself to pieces.
It's a daunting challenge.
Since they can't change the laws of physics or the nature of magnetic fields, how do they manipulate the physical environment to actually survive this?
Well, they rely on the mechanical levers provided by the international standard, IEC 608651. When you look at the master equation for calculating these forces, the designer has two primary physical levers, phase spacing and span length.
Phase spacing makes sense. Just move the bars further apart so the magnetic fields don't interact as strongly.
Exactly. Double the distance between the bars and you cut the force in half.
But as we discussed with the low-voltage cabinets earlier, you just don't have a luxury of space. The boxes are tiny, so if you can't push them apart, you have to use the second lever, which is span length.
Span length is the distance between the physical insulator supports holding the bar. Having the span length, meaning you put twice as many supports holding the bar in place, cuts the total bending force on the conductor by 50%.
It's highly effective, but I imagine it adds a lot of cost and crowding to the cabinet.
It definitely does, which means if space is tight and you've added as many supports as you can physically fit, you have to look at the bars themselves, the materials.
I saw the text comparing copper and aluminum. It says hard-drawn copper has a yield strength up to 300 megapascals. Aluminum, specifically the alloy they use for grids, is down at 195 megapascals. So copper is objectively stronger.
By a wide margin, yes.
Why would an engineer ever choose weaker aluminum when fighting these massive forces?
This is where engineering becomes an intricate art of trade-offs. Yes, aluminum has a lower yield strength and will physically bend sooner than copper. But aluminum is roughly 3.3 times lighter than copper.
And weight changes how things vibrate.
Considerably. Because aluminum is drastically lighter, it alters the natural frequency of the entire span. It shifts the math in that resonance calculation we just talked about.
That is so clever.
It is. Sometimes, using a lighter metal to shift your natural frequency away from that 100 hertz danger zone is a much safer defense than just relying on the brute heavy strength of copper.
That is a brilliant hidden benefit. But it's not just the metal you choose, right? It's the shape you form it into, the geometry. The text talks about something called the moment of inertia, and it basically says a shallow, wide, rectangular bar bends way easier than a narrow, deep bar, even if they contain the exact same amount of metal.
Yes. They refer to a property called the section modulus, which is a shape's resistance to bending. It scales with the cube of the material's depth in the direction of the force.
I picture it like bending a plastic ruler. If you hold a ruler flat on a desk with half of it hanging off the edge and you push down, it bows instantly. Bending it flat is effortless.
Exactly.
But if you turn that same ruler 90 degrees so you're trying to bend it on its thin edge, it's nearly impossible. It's the exact same amount of plastic, just arranged differently to fight the force.
That orientation is everything. Engineers take that principle and push it further with double flat configurations using two parallel bars per phase with a gap between them to vastly increase that section modulus. For outdoor substations, they use hollow tubular pipes to maximize the bending stiffness to weight ratio.
It's all about geometry.
It really is. And interestingly, when using materials like copper, the standard actually allows for a plasticity factor. They explicitly designed the rectangular bars to yield just a tiny bit on their outer edges during the absolute peak of the fault.
Wait, they want it to bend. They don't want it perfectly rigid.
They want it to flex. It's a concept called post-elastic reserve capacity. By allowing a tiny, controlled amount of permanent deformation, the bar absorbs a huge amount of the fault's kinetic energy.
Oh, I get it. Think of it like a crumple zone in a car. It takes the brunt of the impact, so the actual structural anchors, the insulators, don't shatter.
That makes perfect sense. Yes, that's exactly how it functions.
But beyond just the shape of the bar, the text points out that how you arrange the whole system inside the cabinet changes the physics. Like horizontal versus vertical arrangements.
Right, because the arrangement dictates how the magnetic forces interact with gravity.
If you lay the bus bars horizontally, the magnetic forces from a short circuit push the bars side to side laterally. Meanwhile, gravity is pulling the heavy metal straight down. The forces are decoupled, they are acting in different directions.
But if you build a cabinet with the bus bars running vertically,
then you create a massive structural disadvantage. Because the forces stack up, right? Gravity is pulling those heavy metal bars straight down, resting all that dead weight directly onto the bottom insulator. And then the fault hits, and the magnetic force pushes sideways directly onto that exact same bottom insulator.
The forces absolutely accumulate. The text notes that independent finite element analysis studies confirm a vertical arrangement produces roughly twice the net insulator loading of a horizontal one under the exact same short circuit conditions.
Okay, so an engineer has calculated the kappa factor, dodged the 100 hertz resonance trap, turned their metal bars on edge like plastic rulers, and accounted for gravity. The math on the computer screen says the system will hold.
Hopefully, yes.
But how do we actually prove that a hospital won't go dark when the worst happens?
We prove it through a rigid matrix of international rulebooks and through brutal physical torture tests. The global framework relies on a trio of IEC standards.
Let's break those down.
Sure. First, IEC 60909 provides the methods to calculate the raw input, the maximum fault current your specific grid can deliver. Second, IEC 608651, the design standard we've been focusing on, translates that current into physical forces and checks them against structural limits. Finally, IEC 61439 dictates how manufacturers must verify the final assembled cabinet.
And there is a really stark warning in the sources about that metal standard, 608651. It was heavily revised in 2011 to account for a phenomenon called automatic reclosure. What is automatic reclosure and why did it change the math so much?
Well, often, a short circuit on the wider grid is caused by something temporary, like a tree branch brushing a power line. To keep the power flowing, the grid is designed to automatically trip the breaker, wait a fraction of a second for the branch to fall away, and then slam the breaker back closed to restore power.
That makes sense. That is automatic reclosure.
Right. But if the short circuit is still there,
oh no,
then the massive fault hits the system a second time. And crucially, it hits the bus bars while they're still physically vibrating and violently swinging from the first impact.
So they're already stressed to the max.
Exactly. The 2011 standard revision forced engineers to account for this compounded stress. The warning is severe. If an engineer today is using software tools built before 2011, their math might tell them a system is perfectly safe when it's actually a ticking time bomb.
Which leads to how we verify the safety without relying solely on math. The physical testing described in the text is visceral. They don't just run computer simulations, do they?
No. They send these fully assembled units to places like the Warsaw University of Technology Laboratory, which houses massive calibrated fault generators. They literally throw 250 kiloampere peaks at these metal cabinets just to see if they survive.
And then very often they don't, right?
Very often they don't. Companies like Schneider Electric have documented test after test where insulating supports completely rupture. They push the systems until the insulators shatter into pieces, usually because the dynamic resonance amplified the force beyond the material's breaking point.
That is wild.
They sustain the violent fault current for a full second, sometimes 3 seconds, and then inspect the wreckage for permanent deformation or loss of insulation properties.
It's one thing to read about structural load limits on a spreadsheet. It's another entirely to see a piece of heavy industrial steel violently rip itself apart in a laboratory.
It underscores a critical philosophy in engineering. While calculation-based verification is allowed for assemblies that are similar to previously tested designs, it is not a shortcut.
It is an immense responsibility.
It is. The math you use must be just as unforgiving as the physical 250 kiloampere test it replaces. And it has to account for two entirely different types of survival, mechanical withstand and thermal withstand.
Right. We've spent this whole time on mechanical withstand, the instant violent physical punch. But thermal withstand is a totally different mechanism. That's heat accumulation over time.
Exactly. Mechanical withstand is about not snapping in the first millisecond. Thermal withstand is a slow burn. It is verified by what's called an adiabatic equation.
What does adiabatic actually mean in this context?
An adiabatic process assumes that absolutely no heat is lost to the surrounding environment. The fault happens so fast and generates so much intense energy that 100% of the heat generated stays trapped directly inside the metal conductor.
Wow.
The adiabatic equation calculates just how hot that metal bar will get before the breaker finally trips.
So you have to design a system that survives both the physical sledgehammer of the magnetic force and the intense internal melting heat of the current.
And passing the heat check doesn't mean you'll survive the punch, and vice versa. They are governed by completely different physics.
You have to win both battles independently to keep the grid online.
That's exactly right.
It really changes how you see the world around you. You know, the next time you walk past one of those mundane, humdrum, gray switchgear cabinets in the basement of an office building, or you see a neighborhood electrical substation sitting behind a chain-link fence, you aren't just looking at boxes of dumb wire.
Not at all.
You'll know that there is a highly tuned, mechanically and acoustically optimized fortress inside. A structure silently waiting, perfectly braced, ready to absorb and defeat forces that would otherwise tear it apart.
It's modern engineering at its finest. And, you know, that brings up a final thought, something essential to mull over as our infrastructure evolves.
No, what's that?
Everything we have discussed today, the IEC 608651 standard, the squaring of the magnetic forces, and especially that dangerous 100 hertz resonance trap, relies entirely on the physics of alternating current, or AC.
Because AC creates those 100 mechanical pulses every second.
Exactly. But as the engineering text briefly touches upon, direct current, or DC networks, follow an entirely different rulebook, IEC 61660-2. And right now, the global grid is rapidly transitioning. We're building massive battery storage facilities, huge solar farms, and heavy-duty industrial DC microgrids.
None of which alternate. The current just flows constantly in one direction.
Right. So how will these violent electrodynamic forces behave when the current no longer pulses? The invisible river of energy is fundamentally changing its nature. It raises a massive question for the future. Are our physical grids, our legacy engineering models, and our infrastructure truly ready for a purely DC future?